Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today we'll be talking to Bob Kuska, the author of Shake and Bake, The Life and Times of NBA Great Archie Clark. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I wonder if you could start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
I've published three books. Shake and Bake is the third one. That just came out in February. And if you don't have a copy, please consider purchasing one. But prior to that, I did a book on the origins of black basketball in America. It's really the first in-depth book to do that. It was called Hot Potato. And then after that, I did one on, again, kind of a unique book on small college basketball. And I focused on a college in Central West Virginia and took a look at it's a then and now book, and I took a look at how the community used to rally around the college before television and what's happened sort of in the post-ESPN era. My day job, I write about science for a living, and I've done that for over 30 years. And I continue on writing about basketball. I've got another book in the works that's getting close to completion, and it's on the NBA 8.
So how did this project with Archie Clark come about?
I just finished up the small college basketball book, and I wanted to do an NBA book. And Archie was my favorite player as a kid. I grew up in the 70s, and so I contacted Archie, and we set up a time to talk by phone. And Archie said, "You know, let me think about it," and and he agreed, and then just by pure luck, he came down to Washington for a Washington Wizards ceremony, and we were able to meet in Washington. We spent a couple of hours talking about the book and how we'd approach it, and we had a good rapport, and onward we went.
So when you're doing research for this book, and it's clear you did extensive research beyond talking to Archie and others, certainly newspapers, et cetera. Do you kind of come back to Archie and ask for comments on things that you found? Do you, after you've written portions of the book or the whole book, do you run it by Archie to see what he thinks or to make sure it's accurate? How does that interaction work?
A little bit of all. What I did when I started the book is Archie and I, we set up a time for a telephone interview. Now he lives just outside of Detroit, and I'm in the Washington, D.C. area, way out in West Virginia. So we obviously couldn't meet in person. And so we set up a time to talk by phone, and I kind of got a lay of his career and life. And so what I did, that kind of gave me the general themes for the book. And then I went, I would spend a lot of time at the Library of Congress going through newspaper reels and so on to really pin down the facts. I found with a lot of oral histories or biographies in which it's told in the first person, a lot of times the facts can be a little bit loose. So I really want to make sure that everything was accurate. As a part of that, I also did interviews with numerous players that Archie played with or were involved in the era, as well as magazine work as well. And court cases. Yeah, also court cases. I really did dig a lot. And so what I did is I gathered all this information. I would go back and ask Archie could you possibly fill in a blank here? This is what I've discovered, and sort of based on what you've told me and what I've researched, what's your recollection? And then I would put together a draft, and each draft, Archie had trouble. I would email him chapters to begin with, but he had trouble downloading them. So I would print them out and send them off to him, and then we would talk.
Got it. Were there ever any major discrepancies between Archie's accounts of events and what you found in through your research?
Not really. Archie has a very good memory. There were some small things, but no, everything was. I think yeah. So there would be small discrepancies in details, dates, details, things like that. But for the most part, the general themes, and what Archie remembered were totally accurate.
Right. Archie was a fighter, as you portray in the book, and I mean that in a positive way. And not a fight, not physical, right? I don't mean he was getting into fist fights in the court, but he was a tough minded individual who was intent on standing up for his rights, really, at a time when ball players, due to the reserve clause and just the contractual situations in basketball, didn't have many rights. Could you talk about his childhood a little bit and maybe how he developed that toughness that was characteristic of his career?
Yeah, he came from a family that had been in Arkansas. And during World War II, there were jobs available in the GM, the auto factories outside of Detroit. So his father took the family up there. Archie was probably just 4 years old when the family went up there. And they ended up in a little town or outside of Southwest Detroit called Ecorse. And they lived in public housing that was built by the automaker for its black workers. So Archie grew up there. He was a very perceptive kid. He looked at the situation as a young black kid growing up and really the way that the world operated. He grew up poor. There were lots of kids in the family, and it was difficult at times. He always loved sports. He always wanted to be a baseball player. And he got very active playing baseball in Ecorse. But basketball was never really his game. Something that he played and he was pretty good at because he was athletic, but again, baseball was going to be his ticket. And that's kind of interesting because in his senior year in high school, he graduated midterm, so really in the middle of the season. I mean, he really had no plans for basketball. But what happened when he got out of high school is, like a lot of kids who grew up essentially factory towns, Archie always imagined that he would get a job working in a factory just like everyone else. And those were good jobs too, unionized jobs. And unfortunately, right about the time he got out of high school, there was a real economic slowdown. And so Archie was unemployed and he was a member of a community or a group of friends, which sort of in modern parlance, what we might term a gang, but it was more just a group of kids kind of watching each other's backs. There were a lot of different towns nearby where the kids, say from River Rouge, would look at kids from Ecorse, and there'd be a potential conflict between them, between the two. So it was always good to travel in groups. But Archie was elected as the president of that group, and he quickly realized that this was not the future that he dreamed of as a kid. So it just so happened, and this is recounted in the book, that a friend came up to him one day and said, "Hey, look, let's just get out of here. We gotta, you know, go see the world." And at the time, Archie had a brother who had joined the army and was overseas stationed in Germany. And the brother would send home letters talking about all that he had seen in Europe. And the buddy said, "Why don't we do what your brother did? Why don't we join the army? We can join up on the buddy plan." So Archie thought that was a great idea. They went down to the recruiter station, and they had to take a test to get into the army. So they both did, went home, waited a couple of weeks, and sure enough, Archie got a letter in the mail that congratulated him and said, "You know, please report such and such, and you are now a member of the United States Army." So Archie was stoked, went outside, looked for his buddy to see if he got the letter too, and the buddy was kind of cool about it because, as it turned out, he flunked the test. So Archie was kind of on his own and went into the military. He ended up being stationed in Korea. This is right after the Korean War. It was a grueling couple of years there, and again recounted in the book. And but where everything turned for Archie is he was at the end of his stint in the Army. He was stationed at Andrews Air Force Base, just outside of Washington, D.C. Though it was an Air Force base primarily, there was a small Army unit. Archie would show VIPs around Washington. That was sort of his gig at that time. And because he had some downtime, he would go to the Air Force gym and he would play basketball. And he was quickly recognized as being one of the top athletes on the floor. So the Air Force coach asked Archie, "Hey, how would you like to join our team?" And Archie thought that was kind of ludicrous because he was an Army guy. But they said, no, don't worry about it. We've done this in the past. Just go back, ask your supervisor whether he would sign a form allowing that to happen." And so Archie did, and sure enough, his supervisor did sign it, and Archie's the Army guy starred on the Air Force team. And while he was doing that, he was discovered by the coach of the team was a University of Minnesota grad who contacted the coach at University of Minnesota and said, "You've really got to take this kid, Archie Clark." So at the time, Minnesota was trying to integrate. They had signed two black players, including Lou Hudson. And so Archie was tendered a scholarship offer, and he accepted it and went on to Minneapolis, where he starred for the Golden Gophers for three seasons. And, that took him right up to the NBA draft.
You know, Bob, I always say the best sports books are not about sports, or put another way, are about a lot more than sports. You know, they offer a lens into greater societal issues or psychological issues or whatever it may be. And I think this book is a great example of that. One of the kind of themes throughout the book certainly is race. And for those that don't know much about the history of race in the NBA, by Archie came in the league in 1966, conditions had certainly gotten better. You know, the league had been integrated for, I guess, 16 years by then, and conditions for African Americans and opportunities for African Americans had improved, but race was still an issue. So, what was the state of the opportunity for African American ball players when Archie came in the league?
Yeah, so the league originally drew the color line, which was a very odd thing to do. This is in the precursor to the NBA, the BAA. They drew the color line because it was a business decision. They were a little bit concerned about catching on with the public with black players. It was just the racist status quo back then, but more importantly to was the Harlem Globetrotters. Abe Saperstein, the owner of the Trotters, he had first call on all the top black players. And at the time, because the situation was tenuous for pro basketball, a lot of the teams really needed the very, very popular Harlem Globetrotters to come in and play a doubleheader for them so that they could make some extra money at the gate. But that fell away by about 1950, with the drafting of Chuck Cooper and Earl Lloyd. And I remember I met with Earl Lloyd once several years ago, and also another player who played with Earl named Bob Wilson, was an early black player. And they both told me that at the time, black players were expected to do the dirty work. They weren't in there to score. They were supposed to get in there, set the picks, rebound, and then get the ball back out to the white stars, who could shoot one-handed set shots. So that changes with the arrival in 56, I do believe 56 or 57, of Maurice Stokes, who was so talented. I mean, it was clear that things were going to change. You had Bill Russell in the college game, Will Chamberlain, and Elgin Baylor, Oscar Robertson coming through. So it had changed. Getting into the 60s, you did have some black stars, but there was still that concern. How are we going to market a game if it's dominated by black players? So what they did is the owners, in their infinite wisdom, came up with a quota system. It was an unwritten rule that you wanted to have a racial balance on your team. And that was really the solution. So by 66, when Archie came in, that was very much the status quo. And when Archie was drafted, he was taken in the third round. And that was really because Archie had been all Big Ten in his senior year and had put up big numbers. But colleges back then pushed certain players as All-Americans, and Lou Hudson was the one that was being pushed, not Archie. And that's why he fell to the third round. Much to his disadvantage, because the Lakers selected him and really didn't have any plans to keep him, as the book starts out and shows. Archie got lucky in that the player they planned to keep, a white player named John Wetzel, broke his wrist at the end. And so the question that the Lakers faced was, do we want to keep another black player to fill the position they felt that Wetzel was going to have? And they decided to do that. And that was sort of the launch of Archie's career.
Yeah, I love that you started with the book with that for a few reasons. One, because it shows how easily Archie's career could have never happened, right? I mean, as an African-American, if they had cut him, it's possible he would not have received another opportunity and would have just, dwindled away in the Eastern League or something, or gone back to work in the factory. But it's also fascinating because it's a real snapshot of the power dynamic between teams, management, and players at that time. How Lou Mose kind of strong arms Archie into accepting this, below market value, really $11,000 contract. What was the power dynamic like at that time between owners, between the teams, and in particular unestablished players like Archie?
Basically, the owners held most of the cards. I mean, there are with a few exceptions, but the system was set up for management to dominate labor. It goes all the way back to the 1870s and the establishment of the National League in baseball. And that paradigm has been used. It was, baseball famously got its antitrust exemption in 1922. And so the other leagues, without any approval, just kind of piggybacked that antitrust exemption. And that allowed leagues such as the NBA to operate a reserve system, which had never been scrutinized legally in the courts, but it operated, and it was sort of this, something that players were told, you need to focus on your game. Don't worry about the business end. And what happens in 66 when Archie starts to come in is the contracts start to get big. The year Archie came in, the top draft choice was Cassie Russell who went to the New York Knicks, who got what was considered then to be a pretty outrageous contract. And what was different is Cassie Russell was one of the few rookies to have an agent who was able to negotiate a richer contract. The next year, Bill Bradley got a really big contract. Same story. He had an agent to represent him. But for Archie in 1966, coming in as a third-round draft choice, you just weren't going to have an agent represent you. There are stories that go around about lesser players, not a Russell, Cassie Russell, or not a Bill Bradley, but somebody taken in the second or into the first round, trying to bring in an agent, and the general managers and owners just flat out wouldn't talk to them. I mean, that was a quick way to get yourself booted out of the league and ever play. So for Archie, and that this is how the book opens, Lou Mose, who was the general manager of the Lakers, says, I just happened to be in Minneapolis. And, he fully expected, Mose did, to sign Archie within a matter of minutes. This is the contract that you're going to pull out, this dog-eared contract, and said, this is our offer, and, take it or leave it. And in this case, Archie had to take it. And so Archie remembered this moment, just remembered how he got rolled by Lou Mose, and really vowed never again. And the book goes on to show how Archie went to rookie camp with the Lakers, thinking that he had made the team. But he came back for the regular training camp, and that's when Lou Mose, he stopped in at Lakers headquarters to ask Mose where he would be staying. And Mose said, "What are you talking about? You're not staying anywhere. Why not? In fact, you probably have a better chance making the team in Chicago or Baltimore." So, Archie was not in their plans to make the team. And again, a lot of that had to do with the racial balance on the team.
So one of the, interesting themes throughout this book is this power dynamic between management and players and the contractual relationships. And it's fascinating to see how Archie goes from that 25-year-old rookie who gets ruled by Lou Mose to this sophisticated, well-informed veteran who uses his leverage about as well as anybody did in the game at that time. So how did that transformation take place for Archie in terms of both his business acumen and his ability to use his leverage?
So as a rookie, Archie got a little playing time at the beginning of the season, but by mid-season of his rookie year, he was starting in the backcourt alongside Jerry West. He then went on and had a very – there were a lot the Lakers were bitten by a lot of injuries heading into the playoffs, and so Archie really emerged in that playoff series. So Archie was thinking, I really do have a future in the league. And he worked out that summer with a guy named Woody Salisbury. And Woody is a few years ahead of Archie. He'd been a rookie of the year in the NBA. And he had a falling out with Bill Russell. Woody had been playing for the Boston Celtics. And that falling out actually was over a woman. It wasn't over basketball. So Woody was a free agent and was hoping to hook back on with another NBA team. And Archie started working out with him that summer. And Woody Salisbury was a very perceptive guy. And at that time, it was expected that the black players, veteran black players, would kind of look out for the rookies and kind of teach them the ropes. And so working out with Salisbury started telling Archie, this is how this works. What you need to be cognizant of is your productivity. That's what management wants. balance. They look at your numbers, your stat line. So you want to always make sure that you do the best you can to really bolster those numbers so that when you go into contract negotiations, you have something to show them that they can objectively evaluate. At that time, it was changing, but most of the players were on one-year contracts. And so they would go in every summer to re-sign. And that was the case with Archie after his breakout rookie season. And so Salisbury taught him how to move forward. And it's, you know, it's an incredible story. He goes from making $11,000, getting no rookie bonus, to getting a $35,000 contract and maybe jumping a little bit ahead here, but he ends up making over $100,000 in his third season. And $100,000 then was the standard for superstardom. And again, this is a third round draft choice who almost didn't make the Lakers.
Bob, you mentioned early in our call that Archie was your favorite player as a kid. What was it that you liked about Archie or his game?
Archie would term his game out. He said he was a quarterback. We would call it a playmaker today, but he was the guy who ran the show. He was very much in control. In fact, when he went on and played for the now Washington Wizards, formerly the Baltimore Bullets, his teammates there used to call him the general. He was the general who took care of things and kind of very much led everyone else. But on top of that, Archie had a very kind of a little bit of a flamboyant game. Archie developed some moves, some signature moves. One is we now know it as the shake and bake. It's a series of stutter steps to kind of freeze his man, his defender. He approaches his defender, dribbling the ball and stutter stepping to freeze his defender, and then he crosses over. And so it's one of the first great crossover moves. And if you talk to old timers that remember Archie's move, they'll tell you that it's probably the greatest crossover move ever, because Archie, unlike a lot of modern players, didn't carry the ball on the crossover. It was just a very tight move. That would create space for him to shoot a mid-range jump shot or go to the hoop. Also, another thing about Archie is when he was playing that summer with Woody Salisbury, Woody's about 6'7", with very long arms, and Archie's just 6'2". So Archie was having trouble getting his shot off to begin with. So Archie developed what would be, at least as remembered by other NBA veterans of Archie's era, as the first step back move, which, if you think about basketball the way it's played today, you got the step back move and you've got the crossover move. Those are two main moves of the modern game, and Archie was very much one of the originators of both.
Absolutely. So within a couple seasons, Archie went from a guy who, you know, the general manager Lou Mose was pretty sure was not going to make the team, to an NBA All-Star on a Lakers team that included the likes of Jerry West and Gail Goodrich in the backcourt. And then, of course, right after that, he was traded to Philadelphia. How did that trade come about?
Well, the Lakers were owned by Jack Ken Cook, and Jack Ken Cook wanted a championship team for a variety of reasons. It was just kind of went with his kind of flamboyant nature. And the problem for the Lakers all along, they had Jerry West and they had Elgin Baylor, but they didn't have a dominant center. At the time, Will Chamberlain was done with the 76ers. He had had a conflict with the owner of the 76ers, Irv Kozloff, about his contract. Chamberlain had believed that Kozloff's partner, who had died of a heart attack, had promised Chamberlain a third of the ownership stake in the 76ers. And when Kozloff's friend died of the heart attack, Chamberlain raised it with Kozloff, and Kozloff said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And at the time, players, I mean, it's still the case today, but players could not own a portion of an NBA team. So nothing was on paper. Well, Chamberlain took that, felt like he had been cheated, and he wanted out. He wanted out of Philadelphia in the worst way, and felt like he wanted to go to California. Wilt had a pretty large contract as well, and it took somebody like Jack Kent Cooke, who would be willing to pay all that money, to bring Chamberlain to Los Angeles. So with that sort of as prelude, the deal had pretty much been set up that if Jack Kent Cooke was willing to sign Chamberlain to a new contract at the rate that Chamberlain wanted, that the 76ers would be willing to take some Lakers. Among those, the players that they wanted was Archie. So it was a three players that they chose. Jerry Chambers, who great player at University of Utah, and a top draft choice. Archie and Daryl Imhoff, who's a veteran center who had been an early draft choice back in about 1960. But Archie was a key player in this. And Archie realized that the 76ers wanted him under contract before they would trade Chamberlain. And so Archie, using everything he learned from Salisbury, realized that he had leverage over the Lakers and was able to use that to up his salary to over $100,000, which is what I just mentioned earlier. And so all of a sudden, Archie is one of the highest paid guards in the NBA by his third season.
So after, of course, you played in Philly for a few years, and then moved on. He ended up, in total, Archie played for 5 teams over 10 seasons, which is a lot of movement for a player his caliber. You know, Archie was a 2-time All-Star. He was he made second team All-NBA 1 year. And especially back then, there wasn't as much player movement as there is now. Why do you think a player of his caliber bounced around as much as he did?
I think one of the important things to take into consideration is really trajectory. And that is trajectory that you come into the league. Archie was not a number one draft choice. He was not somebody that the marketing department got around from the get-go. They didn't hand him the basketball. So Archie had to fit in, and he became a very accomplished player, and that's why the 76ers wanted him. But what the book also shows, it's the term that a lot of players still use today, and is very apropos, and that is, in the NBA, if you're going to make it, you need to find the right fit. And the 76ers weren't a good fit for you know, as the book goes and talks about, Jack Ramsey, who was a great college coach, was a rookie NBA coach. He was learning the ropes. He wanted to adapt his college coaching system to the NBA. And what he ended up doing is he subtracted a lot of really talented players, and really set up the famous 76ers in the early 70s that set the record for the longest or the most losing season in NBA history. That was set up by Ramsey. And so Archie realized that he really needed to get out of Philadelphia, that it was a bad setup. And so his value was still high. He was putting up good numbers with the 76ers. He just wasn't appearing in All-Star games. And so he got traded to the Bullets, where the fit was very, very good. He got there. Gene Shue, who was the coach of the Bullets, said, "I need a veteran playmaker," and kind of handed Archie the ball. Not only that, Archie was playing with Wes Unseld, who's an undersized but a pretty established young center with a phenomenal outlet pass, which allowed Archie to run the fast break and really just shine. And that's when he, all of a sudden, he's an All-Star again. Not only that, he's a second team All-Pro. So what happened is the Bullets they made a trade. They got Elvin Hayes. So suddenly they've got Elvin Hayes, Wes Unseld, Archie. They drafted Phil Chenier in the hardship draft. Phil Chenier had star written all over him. And so all of a sudden that the Bullets are gearing up and Archie gets paid. Archie gets into a contract dispute with the Bullets, stands his ground, and eventually wins. Archie, his This case goes to arbitration. Archie's the first NBA player to go to arbitration. In a really kind of interesting story, he ends up winning. He gets a big contract offer from the Bullets. And then, as happens with all NBA players, Archie got hurt. And so the book goes from there, talking about the challenges once you've got a chronic injury. And the Bullets realized that Archie was getting older, and he's now damaged goods. Fortunately for luck for Archie, Bill Russell was now the coach for the Seattle Supersonics and had said, if Archie Clark's ever available, I want him. I want him to play for me. So the Bullets were looking to get rid of Archie, and Bill Russell took him. But when Archie was in Seattle, he realized that he was pretty much, with his chronic injury, it was a shoulder problem, that he was pretty much looking at staring retirement in the face. And so he finished that one season with Seattle and then just added another season with Seattle, with Detroit the following year, and then retired.
I had mentioned to you that I heard an interview with Walt Frazier a few years ago in which he was asked which players from his era don't receive enough recognition. And of course, he at first only half jokingly said all of them, but then went on to name a few specifically. Actually, Phil Chenier was one of them. And the other was Archie Clark. And, you know, for me personally, as a huge Knicks fan, that obviously I have great respect for Walt Frazier, that really resonated with me. Does Archie feel like he doesn't receive enough credit or recognition for his career?
Archie's a pretty humble guy. I got to say, I mean, I would say no. I mean, Archie's had a great life, and he realizes that. You know, I think that he would have liked to have been a first round draft choice. I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, why didn't University of Minnesota promote me a little bit more? And that would have made his entry into the league a lot easier. Not only that, if he had been a first round draft choice, perhaps the marketing department would have gotten around him. I mean, if you think about it, he was with the Lakers and all the attention went to Baylor and West, and rightfully so. You know, he gets to Philadelphia and the marketing department there has decided that their new star, now that Chamberlain was gone, was going to be Billy Cunningham. So it was Billy Cunningham and then Hal Greer. And then Archie was sort of, you know, an afterthought. He got to Baltimore, and for a brief period, he was kind of the man there. And then, you know, all of a sudden he's got Elvin Hayes and some other phenomenal players around him. But Archie would say that's fine. That was fine with him. All Archie ever wanted to do was win. He was in it to win. He wanted to win a championship. And so Baltimore was a great situation for him, Baltimore/Washington. And in fact, that team, the nucleus of that team did go on to win a national win an NBA championship. But again, you know, as time marches on and you're going to pick up a chronic injury, it's going to limit what you're able to do on the court. There is that battle, and that's what the book goes into. You know, I've got to say, in writing the book, I've had some people say to me, well, you know, you don't go enough into his personal life. That was never really on the table. When Archie and I talked about doing the book, we wanted to focus on the business, because that the business of basketball, because that angle had never really been done. And so that's what we did. And that's what makes Shake and Bake a little unique than most books, is it really does open up and show you how the business of basketball was transacted in the 1960s into the 70s, right up to the merger, which is the period when modern basketball, everything we know today, was really born. It brought the advent of free agency and big contracts and the merger of the NBA, ABA, and a sort of a different style of basketball and so on.
Yeah, you know, I realized as I asked the question about, you know, Walt Frazier recognizing him and whether Archie feels he doesn't receive enough recognition, that's some pretty damn good recognition, right? I mean, if you're an elite athlete, I think, yes, of course you want the praise and adulation from fans and it's nice to be remembered. But when one of the best players, and even, you know, at the best, same position as you of your generation, speaks that highly of you. When a guy with the reputation of a Bill Russell, you know, lets your team know, if this guy is ever available, I want him. And that's about as good a recognition as you could get, I would think. And I think also, you know, the fact that he did bounce around a lot, has probably, affected the way he is remembered, in that he's not necessarily associated with one particular team. You know, and maybe not brought back to team events the way, you know, guys to think of his generation. Again, my fallback is the Knicks, and of course they won two championships, but, you know, guys like Frazier and Reed and DeBuscher and Bradley, they spent, you know, 8-10 years with the franchise. So in addition to winning there, there's a greater association just because they were there longer. But I'm glad you brought up Archie's injury, because and I have to say, I loved how you focused on the business side of the sport. You know, I've read many basketball biographies, many sports biographies in general, and yes, it's always interesting to learn about people's personal lives and their individual stories. And there's some of that with Archie, certainly with his background. But it was very interesting to me, again, as I said, to use Archie's career to take a look at some of the bigger issues going on, specifically. Again, I keep coming back to this, the power relationship between ownership and player. And one way that was demonstrated was through injuries. Can you talk a little bit about it? It's so different, you know. Now, I was struck, of course, now in the era of load management and the power that the players have, to look back at the way players, management, and owners looked at injuries back then and dealt with injuries back then. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I did an interview with Archie's teammate in Philadelphia, Wally Jones, and which really, really stuck with me. Wally had come up and he's telling me that, you know, we were told, you got to play. If you're injured, you have to play for the team. You know, it was all about, as long, you know, unless somebody shot you with a gun or, you know, you couldn't walk, you were expected to play. And with Archie, and think back to him playing with Woody Salisbury and Salisbury telling him about productivity. Archie arrives in Philadelphia and says to Wally Jones, no, you don't have to play. You know, what you want to do is you want to get out on the court when you're able to play at your best. And he tried to teach that to the other players on the team, which didn't endear him to management, because management, again, just wanted players out there. If the 76ers are going to play in Phoenix and Billy Cunningham is the draw, they want Billy Cunningham on the court playing. They don't want him sitting out. But the concept of load management was considered to be ludicrous back in the 1970s. There's just no way it could happen. And management wouldn't allow it. I mean, there's just an impossibility. So players really did it. The players kind of put their foot down and would say, I can't play tonight, really at their own potential peril. And the book talks about a case a couple years, I think it's Archie's third season in Philadelphia, in which Wally Jones took that to heart and said, I can't play. I've got calcium deposits in my knee. And so he sat out for a while. And really, that was the end of Wally Jones, who's from Philadelphia. We went to Villanova, is very beloved in the city. Their general manager shipped him out. And that was it for him. He fell out of grace because he wouldn't get on the court and play with calcium deposits in his knee.
Unbelievable. Bobby, can you give us a kind of preview? As you said, you're working or almost finished with another book about that era. Can you give us a brief preview of what to expect?
Yeah, so this actually goes back to Shake and Bake. And when I started the book, you know, because Archie's not He's not Oscar Robertson or Walt Frazier. He's not remembered the same way. I was a little bit concerned about marketing the book. And so Archie and also the editor at University of Nebraska Press that published the Shake and Bake, we decided it would be the life and times of Archie Clark. And what happened is, as mentioned, I interviewed Archie and chronicled his career, but the times part just completely exploded on me in a very, very good way. I talked to a lot of ABA owners, administrators, NBA folks as well in the front office, who basically told me how everything worked and gave me insight into how the leagues battled each other. I contacted somebody who is a lawyer in Dallas who had been involved with early on with the ABA franchise in Dallas, who was the league secretary. He sent me all the league meeting notes, minutes from the league meetings through the first four or five seasons. I got all these incredible primary documents about the league. Long story short, I mean, I could go on a little bit longer about that, is I ended up writing a very long manuscript, and University of Nebraska Press wasn't going to publish something that long. So we decided to break it into two. And so I wrote what's published in Shake and Bake is Archie Clark's story, but all the times part really talking about the era and the NBA-ABA war is going to be the second book, which the title will be Balls of Confusion, like the old Temptations song. So it's pretty much written. I just gotta write a few more chapters, and it'll be a go.
Well, I certainly look forward to it. I love the name too, by the way. But I look forward to it because I really enjoyed Shake and Bake. You know, as I've said, it's Archie's story. His personal story is very interesting. But what makes the book so rich is just how you go into the business aspect of the game at that time, and just that dynamic between team and owner in so many ways. And of course, just some of the, I was fascinated just by some of the details of daily life in the NBA at that time, from hobbling through injuries on the court, but also the travel schedule is crazy. You know, how they would, the games would end. They'd have to literally run out the door of the locker room to catch a flight to get in at God knows what hour in the morning at their next location. I think a lot of that, those are the type of things that made it such a great book. Once again, the name of Bob's book is Shake and Bake, The Life and Times of NBA Great Archie Clark. If you love the history of the game like I do, or want to learn more about it, or just interested in the even contractual issues and that type of thing, definitely check it out. Bob, I have one last question for you that I like to ask all my guests. That is, what is your all-time favorite sports book?
Well, this one might surprise you. It's a book. It's also published by University of Nebraska Press. It came out a few years ago. It's the autobiography of another forgotten basketball legend. His name's Billy the Hill McGill, who is the originator of the jump hook. McGill was a tremendous high school star in Los Angeles and went on to shine at University of Utah. But he blew out his knee and ended up playing his pro career on basically one leg. But he was a first round draft choice coming out of Utah, and because of his injuries, it was just tough for him to adapt to the NBA. And kind of amplifying your point, I think sometimes you can learn a lot more about a system, about an organization, by focusing on people who are in the middle, not the superstars who don't have as tough as a job to negotiate contracts. And so for Billy McGill, it just kind of tells this slice of life story. And, things didn't always go well for him. He ended up being homeless and kind of pulled his life back together. And the book was a collaboration with a writer named Eric Brock, B-R-A-C-H. And Eric did an outstanding job telling the story. It's really, if you like good stories, this is it. Definitely get the book.
Thank you. I will definitely check that out. All right. Well, Bob, thanks again so much for coming on. It was great to talk to you about the book. And best of luck with the next book.
Thanks so much for having me. And I can't wait to get the other one done.